Well, hello and welcome to the 39th edition of the Adoption and Fostering Podcast with me, Al Coates, and...
And moi, Scott Casson-René.
All the way from France.
Yeah. It's all right. By the time the next one comes around, I'll be talking with an Irish accent, so, you know.
Oh, excellent.
Just embrace it.
Just suck it up. Cool. Well, hello and welcome to the podcast, and thank you very much for tuning in. And this week we are speaking to Anna Gupta, one of the co-authors of the Adoption Inquiry, the BASWA Adoption Inquiry into the Role of a Social Worker in Adoption. Mm. And you've heard it, haven't you?
I have, yes. Yes. I listened to it today.
Excellent. But before we even go there, I feel it's important that we address a small issue, Scott.
Oh, what have I done? What have I said?
Well, who have I said it to? There was an air of mysticism about a small Twitter poll that you released a little while back.
There we go, yeah.
And what was that Twitter poll? Come on, share with the group.
Well, can I tell the backstory as well?
If you wish. All of it condemns you.
It doesn't. So, oh, God. I thought I'd gotten away with that one. Obviously not. So a couple of weeks ago, Al and I were with a number of other adopters, actually, and special guardians and professionals.
Yeah, a whole range of people.
Yeah. We were at an event that was held in London. And there was a number of things that came out during the day. It was a really interesting day, actually, because it was looking at the
future.
The future of adoption and special guardians. And it was really, really interesting. We met people like Dr. Lucy Peak from Grandparents Plus.
Yeah, Kindred Spirits.
Yeah, really, you know, really intent on improving things for children who can't live with their birth parents.
But she said she'd come on the show, didn't she?
She did, yes. And so that was really good. We've not heard from her yet, but actually I've given, you know, I'm hoping she'll email me soon.
Cool.
Hint, hint. And there was a couple of comments made during the day that actually I was, yeah, that's right, yeah, I agree with that. But there was one comment that was made that just kind of made me think about, I guess you could say at that very point in time, I kind of got a little bit offended by it in some way, because it was a special guardian who made a comment about all adopters were middle class.
That's not fair. Sorry. It's your story.
It's my story. It's how I saw it, not how you saw it. Bear in mind, I was feeling, you know, a little bit
haughty. You'd had extra sugar in your coffee.
Yeah, and how? Well, this is how I heard it. And okay. You know, I may be embellishing a little bit, but not embellishing, but I may have kind of overreacted to it. But basically, what I heard was that all adopted parents were middle class, and all special guardians were likely to be working class. And I just took a little bit offence to it, to be honest with you, because I've always thought of myself as being working class. Given how I grew up and all that kind of stuff that goes with that. And I did. I immediately went on Twitter and created a Twitter poll.
With righteous indignation.
Where do you see yourself sitting in this? Are you working class or are you middle class? Well, apparently...
Before that...
Oh, yeah. You're evil. Evil man.
What?
Well, what are you going to say?
I don't know what I'm going to say. All right, okay. Well, I think the fellow in question did say, he said, generally speaking, and he said, you know, please, and he was very, you know, it wasn't a judgment call from him. He was just saying, generally, special guardians are working class and adopters are middle class. He said, and that was a generalisation. So, and then you immediately looked at me and went, I am all haughty and I am not. And I said, well, you are middle class. You've got the word manager in your job title. Have you? I don't have no idea what your job title is.
I don't actually.
Your janitor, was it? Stationary manager for Adoption UK.
Yeah, paperclip counter.
executive. Executive paperclip counter. And then a few of the other adopters came over and they kind of like, because you were a little bit animated, weren't you, Scott? Let's say animated.
Oh,
Yeah. You are...
No, it's not often. To be fair, it's not often.
No. Your blood was up. And I said, but we're all, you know, we are by, you know, I may have started out as working class lad, but I'm not working class now.
Mm.
And so I tended to agree with him.
Yeah.
But tell me what the Twitter poll said.
It said the majority of adopters think they're middle class.
And I...
I thought you were going to tell a story about when we walked past the bingo hall.
Well,
which was rather.
I'm not sure that casts.
That's when that was actually. It was at that point I went, oh, actually, yeah, you're probably right.
I suggested, actually, as you were still animated by this, waiting for the results eagerly from your Twitter poll.
Yes.
We were walking along.
Which obviously has, you know, it reaches a wide range of people. Yeah, it's
literally. Single digits of people responded to you, literally.
They did not. I had up to, I think it was over 100 responses.
Really?
That
many?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good. So we were walking along and I said, well, come on, let's go and play bingo, you know, because, but then that reflects badly on me, doesn't it? Because I'm saying bingo is a working class.
Exactly.
My gran used to play bingo. She used to go every Saturday to share the winnings with a friend, Mavis.
My mother-in-law still goes. And I said, I would only go if they serve Prosecco. And you said, well, they don't. I said, well, I'm not going.
And then you still protested that you were working class. But I think it's a really good point.
Yeah, well, it is, isn't it? Because you used the word there, generally. So that generalisation, that assumption. And, you know, I guess in some ways, yes, I probably live within the middle class system now. But I still don't feel like that. And I don't see myself like that.
And that's
so it was really, it was a really interesting kind of click in my head that day. And of course, now you call me posh boy all the time, aren't you? So.
Yeah, posh boy. But what it made me think of as well around special guardians, because I think that we share an awful lot of common themes in the children that we care for. And I think that kind of there was a really serious issue underneath, saying that actually, as middle class people, that we potentially have a bit more agency. Mm-hmm. In how we have that impact on our children's welfare. You know, you look at across Twitter and how many teachers or professionals or healthcare professionals and we struggle. That's the reality. Yeah. I struggle getting access to services, and I'm, you know, if anyone shouldn't struggle, it should be me. You know, I'm a social worker. I know I can walk the walk. I can, you know. And so actually, if we are working class and perhaps don't have degrees, and perhaps we don't have access to those services or understand those systems in a way that you know perhaps we are, or access to support, then that's set up even more against us.
That's right.
But also I think that the additional issue for special guardians is that they are still within the communities that their children have come out of, which can add another layer of complexity, which we reflected in that discussion. It was a really interesting discussion.
Yeah,
I think
massively. Yeah. And what was interesting then was that, because that day I also did another event on a similar kind of theme, but with prospective adopters, so approved prospective adopters who hadn't been matched. Mm. And that was really interesting as well, because you think about the time between us as individuals being prospective adopters and the information that perhaps we would have liked to have known now, knowing what we know, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And actually, that on the whole hasn't really changed. Mm. And that really shocked me. Really shocked me. There's still a quite a big gap in terms of knowledge.
When did you last go through a preparation group?
Well, 10 years ago.
For Jacob?
No, not for Jacob. We didn't do one with Jacob because we were foster carers, weren't we? So we did prepare to foster. But,
right, yeah.
But we didn't have to do the adoption one. But that really shocked me. And also, you know, and professionals even acknowledged, so social workers, adoption social workers, all acknowledged the huge importance of peer support. And that was very lacking. Some of the prospective adopters we spoke to didn't have any connections with any adoptive parents beyond the person that they'd listened to on the prep course. And I just thought that was really...
That's a a basic,
yeah,
a really
it's
basic
a fundamental
help.
Element, isn't it? You know,
yeah, a fantastic resource that people can rely on.
Yeah, exactly. So but, I just thought that was really interesting because that the narrative on that hasn't changed.
Well, I mean, said that you say that, but I back in 98, back in the 1898, our first adoption, the only prep we went to, we were hooked up with some adopters who were maybe a year ahead of us who'd got children. So, yeah. But other aspects of our preparation, it just feels like a really an issue that we really struggle to get a hold of, don't we? For a whole host of reasons, how do you prepare people? And even last year, we were talking to John Simmons about preparation, weren't we, and assessment.
Yeah.
And he was kind of saying, you know, we just struggle with it. We just, you know, we really struggle to get to the bottom of how much people can absorb, what people are prepared to listen to and what people listen to. I mean, you must speak on preparation groups, you being famous adopter and all.
Oh, please. But yes, I have.
Middle-class famous adopter, Scott Castleman. Rennie.
Shut up. Oh my God! All right, MBE,
and you'll only speak there if they've got sparkling water.
Oh, I do have to have coffee and bourbons.
See, I'm working class with my bourbons.
Yeah, me and all. Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, I just the whole day was quite inspiring actually, and I felt that whilst there was a lot of things that we knew already. Mm-hmm. There was also that added dimension of the SGO piece, because actually we all make that assumption. Well, no, sorry, that's wrong to say. We don't all make the assumption, but sometimes we make the assumption that they can access just exactly the same as we can. Very little. No, I'm joking. But, you know, they actually have it 10 times worse. And that's something that I've heard a lot over the last couple of months for SGOs.
Well, I think there's a good argument that we work together as a community. You know, that the common things we have are the children and their experiences. Those are things that we share. But you look, how many special guardians are on Twitter?
Yeah, very few.
Where are the communities of special guardians? There is lobby, but it's not as powerful or as vocal as adoption lobby.
No, exactly.
Which I think then goes back to the, but maybe the demographic as well, the potential.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, a lot of that is yeah. Because, you know, I remember I went to the launch of a new agency being run by TACT. And within the launch, they'd invited foster carers and an SGO to talk to the audience about the difference it made since TACT had taken over this agency. And bearing in mind, it's a local authority agency. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm going to mention it, TACT Peterborough, because everybody knows TACT have a 10-year contract with Peterborough City Council to
even
deliver
that
permanent. Exactly. And just the difference in that model, you know, the fact that TACT came along and they've actually looked at training their SGOs and how they support them. Now, this lady stood on the stage or sat on the stage, and she actually commented that she was very close to losing her grandchildren in her care because she wasn't able to deal with their needs and their behaviours. And one of them's been diagnosed with FASD and one's been diagnosed with ADHD. And, you know, they've got another a wide kind of range of special needs. And she was at risk of losing them and until TAC came along and TAC gave her the foundations to be able to parent them properly. And that's the kind of, that should be the minimum that we would expect to be giving to people who, to grandparents, aunts, uncles, friends, you know, neighbours, whoever it is, that are taking on the responsibility of looking after these children so that they don't, you know, so they don't drift, really.
And they get the best that's available.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Because, you know, I mean, I'm not going to talk about the
preemptors.
Yeah, but, you know, that comes out in that, doesn't it? It's about that adoption being the gold standard. And it's not the golden standard. It's not the gold standard for all children. It suits some in the same way long-term foster care suits some, the same way staying within the birth family suits some. It's not, you know, it's not something that, yeah. And it needs to be treated as such. It needs to be on an equal footing.
No, and I think that the one thing we came away from that day was, which I think was a fantastically interesting day, because it was Andrew Christie, head of the Adoption Leadership Board, saying, actually, what are we going to do? What is the plan for 2030? What is adoption support going to look like over the next decade, more than a decade? And some really interesting themes came out. And it was exciting to see that level of forethought rather than we'll fix this week and have a look.
Exactly.
So yeah, how is that gonna peter out? Not peter out. prophetic. Talking about like ongoing, consistent relationships with authorities, which I think is a huge challenge.
Well, it is. Yeah. You know, and you look at some of the, you know, commissioning exercises, and I spoke about this a couple of weeks ago with somebody, and I can't remember who it was, but we were talking about financial years and how local authorities who have the statutory responsibility for looked after children and adoption support and all that sort of stuff, they go on financial years. So they go from the end of, from the beginning of April to the end of March every year. A child's cycle does not work in a financial year.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work over 3 years. You know, and the just referring back to the TAC Peterborough model, what I heard from that, and it was really, and it was Andy Elvin actually said it, the CEO of TAC. He said, you know, we've agreed a 10-year contract with Peterborough City Council because, you know, 3 years isn't going to cut it. 5 years isn't going to cut it. You know, these children will be with us beyond the age of 18 in some cases. Well, in a lot of cases, actually. So you can't just say, well, we'll commission that service for 3 years
and
hope that it might work. And then we'll try and cut them down on the price after 3 years, you know, that kind of thing. And even the guy, I can't remember his job title, but I think it was this, the Director of Children's Services at Peterborough. He said the same as well. We are committed to this for at least 10 years with an opportunity to extension it to you know, extend to 20 years if needs be. And now, that's a commitment, and that's what's needed.
I think
not
it's
just 3 year commissioning.
Incredibly brave, because I think, for especially for the looked after children, as I work for an independent foster care agency, and we have no statutory duty to take children at all. Yeah. We can say any referral that comes to us, we can say we can't place that child.
Yeah.
We haven't got the appropriate foster carers. There's no good matches, which is. Right, which is suits us perfectly, because we're not then trying to put square pegs into round holes, if you'll excuse the crude phrase. But to go into a local authority and say, we will take over that statutory duty where you have to. So, you know, it's whatever it is, it's 10:30 tonight. If the call comes in, we need to place a child, you have to place a child. And and it falls on the shoulders of some poor placement officer for that local authority who's got a statutory duty to place that child. And so I think for an organisation to go in and willingly take on that duty, they've got to really be confident they can do it.
Exactly.
And to do it well, because I think a lot of local authorities do fall foul of any port in a storm. You know, it's 10:30, the day before Easter Friday.
Yeah,
and you say, you'll know. Yeah. We all know, anecdotally, we know.
Yeah.
Little Johnny, you know, don't care what he is or what he does.
No.
And I'll.
But he needs a bed.
Yeah. And I hold our duty phone on and off. And so I got a call. I've had a call at 4 o'clock in the morning from a local authority's referral team placement officer saying, we need a foster carer now. And then it's 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm thinking, who am I? Where am I? Right. Okay. Yeah. You know, why am I talking about working? Is this a dream?
Yeah. You know, another one of your dreams.
Yeah. Where's the queen? And then I kind of get my wits and I go, right. Okay. Give me a quick rundown of the child and say, well, you know, he's in a police station. Right. Okay. Why isn't he in a police station? He's in a police station because he's assaulted his carer.
Right.
Okay. And you want me to put him with another foster carer tonight? A serious question.
Yeah.
And I'd say, I'm sorry, my heart goes out to you. And I said, my heart goes out to you, but I haven't got a carer who I'm prepared to do that on the limited information you've given me. So, and that's the reality of fostering. And I think it's very easy to get people can step back and go, oh, well, you know, it should be like this and that and the other. But that's the reality for a lot of children. Yeah. Because the stock take, and we're going to speak to Mark Bowers, aren't we?
Mark Owers.
Oh, why do I keep calling me Bowers?
I don't know why you call him Bowers.
Poor man.
Apologies, Mark.
Really, he won't be listening. He's far too important to listen to this.
That's true.
It's true. Mark Owers, who's co-wrote the Fostering Stock Take, which has been universally disliked. So I'd be really interested to speak to him about that. But also, he's an adopter as well, isn't he?
Yeah, And I think that's what's quite interesting about it, because I'd be interested to kind of hear his views on
all of it.
Yeah, on all of it, yeah.
And I think he's got a fantastic story. Hugh Thornbury told me, I was in a meeting with Hugh Thornbury, and he went, see him over there. And he told me his story. That was quite an odd moment.
There's your name dropping again, honestly.
Yeah.
Goodness, honestly. So, well, I just wanted to mention one thing, because you've obviously got me over a barrel with the middle class thing. So okay. I've just got to mention one thing that actually the other PB. Day... Yeah. Bosh boy. But I've got something to put back to you, and that's about, and I'm not going to tell you where it came from, but you've been referred to as my straight husband. Silence. Tumbleweed.
I'm trying to work out what that even means.
Well, apparently that means that, I don't know what that means, actually, just thinking about it.
Is it a compliment?
I think it must mean that someone thinks that we've got a rather
like Eric and Ernie.
Yeah. I was going to say Ant and Dec, but I don't think we'll go there right now.
Move on.
Yeah, a bit like Eric and Ernie. We've got
podcast towers sharing a bed, but on a purely platonic way.
Yeah, with pajamas.
Pajamas.
Buttoned right up to the top.
too far.
I actually questioned this person, because it was just literally...
Who was it?
Went, oh, it's like, I'm not telling you. And it was because they'd been listening to the podcast. And they said, it does sound like you're kind of a couple. And we've had this comment before, haven't we, from someone else?
Well, it wasn't a comment, it was a genuine belief.
Well, it was, yes, that's right, yeah. Who we've not heard from in a while, so let us know you're still alive, please. I just thought it was really interesting, because to say my straight husband, which would mean what? I don't know what that actually means, but I think that...
A marriage of convenience.
That, yeah, we're very comfortable together, I think was what they were trying to get at, that, you know, you've got all of your things that you do, and I've got all of my things that I do, and yet we come in and we don't seem to fall out about our own opinions, and our, we don't disagree and stuff. And I thought it was quite a nice little...
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem with anything you say, because I just know that you're wrong.
Just delete, and you delete it out as well, so, whatever.
Yeah, I just...
You just know I'm wrong, did you just say?
No.
Oh, my God, right, that's it. What's it? Hashtag podcast tiff, was it?
Podcast tiff. And I never even liked your beard. No, I do. I think your beard is fetching.
I was just going to say, you're making it sound like I don't have it. I've still got it.
Yeah, it's very good. That's nice to know that people are bothered, I think. But if our partners find out, it could turn ugly, couldn't it?
Well, I don't think so. I think they'd actually be quite pleased to get rid of us.
Well, you speak the truth there. We finally agree on something.
Yeah. I saw a comment that Mrs. C made on Facebook earlier about the posh boy thing.
No, I've not seen that. What did
she
say?
She said, Mr. Al Coates, bear in mind, you are co-owner of three horses, so you can't talk.
I'm not even pretending that I'm anything other than middle class.
Are you not? Hello. Oh, yeah, she put, and you, Al Coates, have part shares in three horses. Tally-ho!
I hate horses. Three horses. That makes me sound so middle class. Now you've really... Yeah. I'm not middle class. I am middle class. I'm confused.
It was really interesting, because the last time I've seen you with a horse, and you're not interested, you really don't like horses.
No.
But interestingly, the last time that was the night with the pink gin, which we were having a conversation about the other night on Twitter. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were going to die that night.
It was a bad reaction to those things you made on the barbecue.
It was a bad... That last one was a bad pint. I fear for the people who've tuned in, listening to, hoping to listen to something.
It's just like our
insightful
phone calls. You know, we just waffle on, don't we?
Yeah, prattle prattle.
I do think we should bring our textbook. I really do. I think we might be onto a winner there. We'll speak to Jessica Kingsley and ask them to publish all our texts.
Well, actually, do you know what? You say that, and I was thinking, do you remember? And I really apologise for anyone who's still listening that I can't tell you anything about this. But I was thinking, there's going to come a day when this all ends, right?
What?
Our careers, right? Naturally ends.
What career is that?
Well, you know. And I think we've got a story to tell about a podcast guest, haven't we, that we must tell that story on the last podcast.
Okay.
Do you remember the episode just before Christmas we nearly made?
Oh yes, yes.
We got
the one
to tell...
we might as well have just got, you know.
No, don't even go. Don't
shot each other.
No, yeah, just exactly. Right.
Yeah. Anyway, yes.
That is a moving great on. Story. That's a window into our lives.
Yes.
And so
stay
many
tuned.
Other things.
On yeah. Episode 6,325,000. Anyway, poor Mrs. Anna Gupta. She's sitting yes. there waiting to be played.
Patiently.
So
yeah. Making sure we didn't libel her.
Yeah, it was an interesting conversation.
It was, and I was really pleased we spoke to it. So I'll put it on, and then maybe we could feedback on that afterwards.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that. Press play.
Cool. Well, Anna, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Could you tell us who you are and how you ended up being involved in the adoption inquiry?
Well, I'm Anna Gupta. I'm Professor of Social Work at Royal Holloway, which is part of London University. And I work as a social work academic on their master's course and on the post-qualifying courses and PhD program. My interest is in childcare social work, right. Child protection, family court work, children looked after, adoption and fostering. So I... together with my colleague Breech Featherston, we put in for a tender. A tender was sent out by BASWA for the inquiry, and we put in a tender. I think it was probably December 2015,
right.
And it was agreed and around February, March 2016. So we got it was a competitive tender, and we got it.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite a while ago, isn't it? I mean, in some ways, the adoption landscape seems to have shifted quite dramatically over those three years from tender to reporting, doesn't it?
It's about 2 years. It's about 2 years since we started the project.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I spoke to a lot of people and they'd kind of had a presumption of where you were going, that you would be against adoption. But that's not how it reads. Was that something you'd heard before that?
Yes, we had heard that, that's what people were expecting of the report, you know, written by Breech and myself. Certainly I hope that doesn't come across in the report at all. I mean, we didn't find evidence of many people at all thinking that adoption was wrong in principle or had a problem with adoption per se. I think the issues were much more about practice, and the practice of adoption, and particularly a more closed model of adoption, as it is certainly in England and Scotland and Wales, and some of the policy context in England, but also particularly when looking at the wider social policies, which are cutting family support, increasing inequality, and increasing workloads and resourcing to local authorities. So that was, it's within that context, practice was seen as elements of practice were seen as problematic, but not adoption per se. Yeah.
I've chatted to a few people about the inquiry, and there seems to be a little bit of confusion amongst the wider community about what the actual inquiry was for. So, I mean, so I'll go directly to you and say, what was the scope and purpose of the inquiry?
Well, in the sort of tender document, the BASWA, the British Association of Social Workers, wanted an inquiry into the role of the social worker in adoption with a focus on ethics and human rights in order to provide BASWA with an up-to-date knowledge and evidence from key stakeholders, so social workers, adopted people, adopted parents, birth families, policymakers and academics, and legal practitioners on this aspect of social work practice, you know, how ethical and human rights issues and legislation are understood and informed practice. So they wanted us to gather up this knowledge by talking to the different stakeholders.
Mm-hmm. And that's quite a different perspective to the one that we see, or a different viewpoint to the one we see. Because I, well, you know, I kind of am active on social media and all that kind of that world. but we don't hear the voice of social workers very often. We don't hear the voice of birth families. And was it, do you think that was the purpose behind Basel, just to kind of get that perspective?
Yes, it certainly was. Well, to get the perspectives of all involved, yeah, or as possible, many stakeholders as possible involved. I mean, there were others, other professionals we could have, but within the scope of what we were doing, we particularly focused on family members affected, and that's birth and adopted family and adopted people, and the social and legal professionals, and included in that's children's guardians, and as well as academics.
So that's a really, I mean, that's a broad spectrum of people who kind of have an interest or an influence over adoption. And were they as groups of people willing and happy to contribute?
Yes, they were. Yes, on the whole, people were. Certainly, we had to. I mean, we used different methods of accessing people. Primarily, it was through the questionnaires, but we also had the seminars where we invited participants, and we had face-to-face interviews and some focus group discussions. So, for example, with CAFCAS, it was a focus group discussion, because we went through the organisation.
Yeah.
Similarly, we did interviews, face-to-face interviews with birth family members and adopted people and adopted parents who requested that instead of the questionnaires.
Yeah.
So I suppose, we tried as far as we could to get a wide spectrum of people, and it wasn't that difficult.
Yeah, because I guess some of those voices are more marginalised, and the opportunity to speak has been not necessarily afforded to them.
And we went through groups, certainly with birth family members, support groups, for example, Women's Centre in Halifax, as birth family members are sometimes quite difficult. And similarly with young adopted people, we went through the Quorum Adoptables group, because I think adopted people are actually a group. You know, we think about birth families, but I think we also need to think about adopted people as a group whose voices aren't heard in that as often, particularly young adopted people.
Yeah, they're an interesting group to access, aren't they, because of the nature of adoption and privacy, I guess, people, how people feel about it and how they want to contribute to the debates and discussion. So did you, so you did that, and that's, it was a big piece of work, sounds is a horrible phrase, but it was a big task, wasn't it, gathering all these views? And
yes.
Yeah, you said it. Yes, very tired.
Yeah, very tired.
And I was at one of the days where you drew together different professionals, and I have to say it was really, really interesting day, and not without its tensions, if
absolutely,
I'm honest. Yeah, because you've got a group, different communities in a room together, from that don't necessarily, you know, get together in rooms together. So I think it was chaired wonderfully by yourselves. But yeah, very, very interesting, and I was looking forward to the inquiry coming out, and I know it's been a while coming out, but so cut to the chase, what did you discover?
Well, I suppose starting off from the first thing, I think picking up on that point of the seminars, but also just the whole idea of getting the different perspectives, it was just a really important and in some ways unique opportunity for those impacted by and working in adoption in the seminars, engage in dialogue together, and then for us to bring together different views. And I just think as a way forward, we really need to build on constructive dialogue between different people involved in the process, and, you know, try and help dispel myths and develop respectful and restorative relationships that encourage this type of dialogue, so that people can hear the different voices and the different perspectives. It's a very emotive area, and it can easily become polarized, and people stop listening. And I think that's really unhelpful in terms of taking forward, best practice for all involved.
Yeah, I do. Sorry,
go on.
No, I was going to say, I do sometimes wonder, kind of the it's a quite a common social work model, isn't it, that people are experts by experience. And they have certainly have insights to offer that aren't necessarily available through other routes. But sometimes with something like adoption, I sometimes wonder whether that people who, like yourselves, who can stand outside and look in, and they can offer perspectives that we don't, because we are, you know, it's our children. Everyone, you know, around that table, these are our children, rightly or wrongly, you know, or correctly or incorrectly, however you want to frame that. But actually, to get your perspective, so did you find it easy to kind of stand back from all of that and be, were you, you know, to be subjective or objective? Sorry, not subjective.
I mean, we all bring our different sort of feelings and views and assumptions to processes. And you know, as researchers, Brij and I and Sue, who is our research assistant, you know, we're very conscious and tried to be reflective about these, so that, you know, we were trying to try and understand the different perspectives as best as possible and try and you know, within the context of bringing our own work and ideas and values, as everyone does, we were trying to be as objective as possible and listening to all of those views. Yeah. I mean, it's not an easy process. It's not an easy process hearing different people's stories, and some very, very painful stories we heard from various people involved. It was interesting for me reflecting on the process. As someone who's worked as a social worker and still does some work in the family courts, but also I think importantly as a researcher that's done a lot of work with social workers and families involved in the child protection system, I suppose the most for me impactful was listening to the adopted people's stories.
Right.
I found that absolutely fascinating and really enlightening. And it's something I'd really, you know, as a research area to take forward, I think it's so important. I've now sort of forgotten your question.
It's okay.
The process.
If it was a good question, you'd have remembered.
Very, very enlightening for us. And certainly we tried our best to be as best to encompass all the views and assimilate them and try to be as objective as possible.
Yeah, that may be slightly, I don't know, I didn't want that to come across as an accusation of partiality. It was just kind of a question, because I thought actually getting drawn into that really complex emotions from lots of different perspectives must have been quite hard. So really what, I mean, I know the Adoption Inquiry Report can be accessed online, so you know, we haven't got the time or inclination to kind of go through blow by blow. But what were the main findings that you?
I'll go through just the main, because there's quite a lot in the report. In terms of the broader view on adoption, certainly. I suppose a key thing that came out is the importance of seeing adoption within the wider sort of social policy context. I mean, we looked at adoption. We looked at when it was focusing on adoption, but we didn't look at international adoptions. We didn't look at separate adoptions. It was adoptions from care, which are the largest number of adoptions in this. The four countries, and so it needs to be discussed within the context of wider social policies. I suppose the findings can be thought of as a broadly about adoption practice as it is, but then specifically there were issues related to adoption in the current context of austerity as well. So a number of social workers, birth families, adopted families, legal professionals, expressed concern about the wider child protection policies and the impact of austerity on public service resourcing, on benefits, on social services, on children's services, the time, the caseloads, and the family support services, and that that needed to be thought about, and that research showing that children living in poverty and living in socially deprived areas are more likely to be come into the care system. So those issues need to be discussed and adoption seen in that context. But there was also findings in relation to the model of adoption used at present, and particularly around the closed nature of much of adoption, certainly closed in terms of direct contact in England in particular, but also in Scotland and Wales. That wasn't the case for Northern Ireland, where there were sometimes concerns about judges recommending contact take place too often, direct contact. But in England and Wales, we sort of heard a lot of concerns about a very proceduralized response to contact, and that it was sort of the default position was letterbox contact, and
you've opened up a huge thought track in my mind, because I think that's really interesting. But so you mentioned in Northern Ireland that it's much more common. Sorry, I'm sorry to cut across you, but I just think, oh, I wasn't aware of that. That Northern Ireland is perhaps, is it a cultural thing, or is it just a practice issue that makes contact much more sort of...
Well, it comes from the courts, it comes from the judges. Some of the social workers that we spoke to expressed disquiet about the sort of expectations around direct contact, sometimes between 4 and 6 times a year, that was expected.
That's a lot.
By judges. Particularly when there was limited amount of post-adoption support services. I mean, that's the other thing that came across very, very strongly is, and obviously something that you're very close to your heart, is that the lack of post-adoption support services for adopted families, for children, for birth parents, but also, really importantly, I think for adopted people throughout their life.
Yeah, so, no, yeah, I mean, so that's, it's really interesting.
Was it did stand out as being quite different.
Because I think that even yesterday I was reading something by a group of adopters who were saying, whoa, slow down on contact. We've got our concerns, we've got our worries, and rightly so that they express that perspective. But then I've also seen within days other situations where adopters saying, I want more contact, but I'm being held back by the policies and procedures of my local authority, or a kind of a risk averse culture, or just don't know where to start. I'm getting no help, and I want support in that. So I think that of all of the recommendations that came out, that was one of the ones that I kind of went, that remains a really kind of prescient and focused issue for a lot of families, but on both sides of the coin.
Absolutely. And we heard stories from both sides of the coin as well, from adopters wanting to pursue it more and for others expressing reservations about it. And again, if it is going to change, if the landscape of there is going to be more direct contact, it needs to be supported. I mean, it would, it can't just happen without a resource and culture change within local authorities around post-adoption support.
And what was the, because obviously the focus of the inquiry, which again, I keep, when people talk to me about the inquiry, I keep saying, yeah, but read the title. The title is The Role of the Social Worker in Adoption. People either just have thought it was something it wasn't, or thought it should be something that it couldn't be. But what was the perspective of professionals in relation to contact?
Well, varied, but certainly there was amongst social workers an openness to think about it for a lot of the social work respondents, but with the caveat that it needed to be resourced. There were concerns expressed by particularly social workers but also obviously from the family members, as I said about letterbox contact. You know, generally open to the idea, but, you know, with concerns about the lack of support services that would be provided.
Yeah, which I think is what probably is reflected by most people, is that what we don't want is this blanket approach, this, you know, like you said, this rubber stamping of, oh, what sort of contact? And it's as though someone ticks in a box, letterbox, because that's
what I think absolutely. And I think having the Northern Ireland, you know, shows that as well. It shouldn't be a proceduralized, routinized response in either way. You know, in England, it is just a letterbox or direct contact with Northern Ireland, or often is Northern Ireland. And I think that, it's got to be an individualized approach.
Yeah.
That looks at this particular child and you know, the adopted family and the birth family. I think the difficulty is that plans are set at the time of the court hearing, and that can be that's not certainly not the best part time to think about how to support the different people in the adoption line.
And why do you say that? I'm just curious, because I was reading the report last night, and I found some of the insights by social workers about adopters very interesting and rang true to me about what people say and what people do at that point of contact, or that point of making adoption orders, what adopters would say beforehand, and then what would actually come into fruition about what they promised they would give. And was that something that you were surprised by?
I wasn't particularly surprised by it, because I've come across it in my work. It was said on a number of occasions by, you know, by social workers. It's at that stage. That's this problem, but it's not just the doctors. It's also often birth families are in a very traumatized and an emotional state, and so they're often not seen as willing or able to manage contact, whereas they might be if it was further down the process that decisions are made. But so often very little work is done with birth families as well. So there's no sort of flexible response to changes in the various different people, and of course the child's views on the process.
Of course, yeah, which again is so often overlooked or not kind of weighed or balanced appropriately. Speaking of what adopters promise, the comment I found really interesting as well by adoption social workers was in relation to changing names. Complicated.
Yes. Yeah.
I found what I really liked about the report was the fact that it was you were listening to voices that don't normally get heard. And I think that is one of its great strengths, is that all the way through, these are voices of different people who are just as invested in the adoption process, and some just as equally as any other member. You know, adopters, I feel that we do get more than a fair crack of the whip. I can say that because I'm an adopter. I'm saying that as an adopter, not a social worker. And it was good to hear other people's voices. One of the issues, because there was a series of recommendations at the back. I feel like we could talk about your inquiry, sorry, for so much, because there was so many points that as I read it, I really pinged off the page to me. But one of the other ones that I found really interesting was about the status of adoption and its relationship to other permanence options. And you sort of made a recommendation about that. What were you looking at? What were you saying in relation to that?
I think certainly what we found, particularly in England and to a lesser extent in the other three countries, was the promotion, including by senior members of the government at various times, of adoption as the gold standard.
Yeah.
and you know, that's to be strived for. And I think what happens in the process is that other options that could offer possibilities, I mean, long-term fostering being a crucial one, that might not involve the severance in such a way, particularly, you know, of contact arrangements, of relationships, was often given less a priority.
Yeah,
wasn't considered in any detail, and so it. Yet, actually, what we should be looking at is what's the right option for this child, and looking at the various different options, particularly around sibling groups, and that that process. Certainly, what we heard, particularly again from social workers in England, was much harder when there was a sort of dominant narrative that adoption was the best.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, thinking across the whole report, was there any element of it that you came as a surprise to you? Because you're quite, you know, you're in that world. But was there anything that you weren't expecting?
That's quite a difficult question.
Sorry.
I suppose for me, and this is just again because I've been quite into this, in the system itself and how the system works. So I suppose for me, the most not surprising, but the most powerful, and I'm going back to what I said earlier, was the identity issues through the lifetime for adopted people. Now, from a lot of people listening to this would go, well, why is that a surprise? But actually, from my perspective and my, you know, my yeah. knowledge, and I've, you know, my work has been primarily children and family social work and not through, but the sort of long-term implications and the struggle that people can get accessing specialist adoption services through yeah. their lifetime. I thought that was, that for me was the most, surprising is not the word, but the most poignant finding, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I was talking to, for the podcast, I was interviewing Bridget Bett from After Adoption, and she was talking about her experience as an adoptee, but also her experience working with children. And again, it was profoundly moving, the reality that this is not a, this adoption is not a moment in time. It's a state of being. That
absolutely, yeah. It's not an event.
Yeah, and that was quite sobering. And it comes out of your report. I would really encourage people to read it and reflect on its purpose. And I have encouraged people to read it. So, you know, but what's been the response to it?
Varied. Certainly varied. We've had lots of positive feedback, and we are really, really pleased that Lord Justice McFarlane, in a lecture last week at the Ngauro Conference on Contact, described it as a very interesting and important report, saying it made a huge contribution. I don't know, maybe not that word, but an important contribution to discussion about contact, and quoted parts of the report. So we were really, really pleased with that.
Yeah, of course.
And, so from a lot of people, we've had a positive response. We've had some not so positive, but I think on the whole, it's been very positively received.
Yeah.
And we're disseminating it in various ways through conferences, through papers, through our teaching, etc.
I'll be honest, I live in, you know, if you drew a Venn diagram of my world, I cover all kinds of peculiar corners. So I found that it's not been particularly well received by some adopters that I've spoken to, which I'm genuinely surprised by. But I don't quite understand that. So do you understand some of the criticisms that have been levelled at it? They were talking about how relevant is this? Is this telling us anything new? But and I don't want to focus on the negative particularly. But
it's fine. Yeah. I think it goes back to what people were expecting from it. You know, it's not a report going. for example, evaluating outcomes in adoption. It wasn't, you know, it was never set out to be that. It is about getting people's views, engaging in discussion, thinking about, very, you know, broadly, the role of the social worker, what's happening in the process, and a particular focus, which we haven't talked about, but is, you know, social work and ethics.
Yeah.
And human rights issues, and human rights issues not being part of it. So I think possibly some of the people might have been expecting something different.
Yeah.
Other than that, I don't know. I mean, because the main criticisms I saw were sort of on social media. So it's quite hard to get the reason for it when it's on social media.
Yeah, they're not often measured, or they're very binary, aren't they? They don't particularly. Yeah. There's no nuance to them or explanation.
A group called Special Guardians and Adopters Together contacted us because they found that the report resonated with their experiences as adopters and special guardians of seeking support from local authority when things become a child protection system. They were a group of adopters that were quite encouraging about the report.
Oh, that's good. That's good that they got in touch and passed on their regards. Can I pull you back to ethics? Because I wonder whether that's a complicated area, isn't it? And we all bring our different ethics to the table. So were you, and I wonder whether that's a debate that sometimes adopters are not particularly comfortable to look into, because it's murky, isn't it? But also, I know from a social work perspective, I've seen things that I've been really uncomfortable with in relation to adoption practice. But where else can we talk about that? You know.
And I think that's another, I would hope, that's something that could be taken away from the inquiry, is that we need more spaces to think about these things. We need more spaces. Yeah. I mean, social workers need to be allowed to, and be given time and encouragement to think critically about the ethical issues in their practice.
Yes.
And how it links to wider social context, structural factors. But also, I mean, social workers need to do that, but so does really everyone else involved in the whole process. Mm-hmm. To think about how we care for children within our society, wider social policy issues, what we want our society to look like.
And that was one of your first points, and I wrote it down. About adoption within a wider context, and we're not having that conversation anywhere, are we?
No. But in some ways, I mean, certainly, I don't think it's hard, because I don't think adopters should feel blamed by this, and I think some might. It's not their fault, but the system, that society, that austerity, that cuts are happening. I've read blogs by adopters that some of the respondents to this, you know, that are quite a number of the adopters responded to this in a way that they didn't feel comfortable with a society that didn't really try to support vulnerable children to remain within their families, and that removal was something that was a last resort.
Yeah.
And given that there are, in the context of adequate services being provided for families. So I think that, I would hope that adopters would also, on the whole, understand that it's not anti them. It's about actually adoption within a wider policy context of how we look after our marginalised and vulnerable families.
And I think that is, you're right in what you say, that adopters, perhaps there's a a reservation in having those conversations, because I know that when I really bottom out some of the stuff I know about my children's history and my motivations to adopt, that actually there is no black or white, there's no right or wrong, it's all shades of grey.
Absolutely.
And that's slightly uncomfortable to come away from that thinking, if this had happened here or that had happened there, then... And that's not necessarily, you know, we're not equipped or supported to have those thoughts or conversations. We're kind of left to people like you to have those conversations, but then we can all sit in and snipe, can't we? We can snipe and say, well, this, that and the other about what other people are saying. But I think there are lots of adopters who want to have those conversations, and I've certainly had those, you know, I've got a group of very close friends who are adopters, and we have those conversations, and they're not comfortable conversations. So maybe it's about adoptive feeling a bit of vulnerable, and we're not used to being at the bottom of the pile and all of that. Was there another couple of things I wanted to kind of comment, just as an encouragement really to you, is that I looked through the recommendations again last night, and I realised that some of the things you're recommending are sort of happening, that people are asking the questions about, you know, contact. And I see that more and more in the circles that I move in. People are saying, this is an issue that we cannot just put on the side, around contact, around its adoption's position in the wider context in relation to other options of permanence. And there are people who are having those conversations. So, you know, take heart.
Oh, good. Thanks. I read your... I think it was a very recent blog about a conference of John Simmons and Beth Neal where was discussed. And I think, what did you say was your big question? Well, what can we do about it?
How do we change it?
How do we change it? Yeah.
That we're not back here in 20 years' time and someone else has written a report. And
exactly. Because Beth has been doing work on this for many, many years, really good work.
Yeah, 21 years, she was saying. But what worried me in that she said openly, she said that I'm seeing less contact now than then. Now, that might be... there might be a good reason for that, but you would hope that we would be progressive and our practice would be developing, not broadening then rather than restricting.
Yeah, I mean, just from my experience, rather than research and work, I completely agree with that. I think it's backwards. Yeah.
So we're getting Beth. Beth is going to come on the show next week. Oh, not next week, but in a few weeks' time. And to try and kind of get her message out, because she's got some really interesting information. But we're not here to talk about Beth Neal. We're here to talk about the adoption inquiry. So, I mean, is there anything else from that we haven't discussed that you would like to communicate, or any points that I've not picked up on?
There's loads, but I can't. I can't. There's loads. I'm just trying to think. I think we've covered the main. I think we've covered. Let's. I mean, there are lots of findings we mentioned, but in terms of the recommendations, I think we've covered most. Let me just go through them. Yeah, just located and discussed within the wider context of poverty and inequality. The open approach and the status of adoption, and I suppose just the importance of support services.
Yeah.
For all involved.
Everyone.
Yeah, for everyone. And, you know, if there's one thing we can do quite easily, I'm sorry. But
no,
I just,
please, tell me.
Back to a bit of my hobby horse, we really need to look at letterbox contact. Our local authorities can do that differently and at least begin to provide better support, because it feels that it's just recommended in court all the time and without any thinking about how does it work? Does it work?
Does it? Yeah. Is it functioning?
Is it functioning? You know, it's quite a tangible thing that local authorities could look at.
Monitor and review that. I mean, anecdotally, I heard a story on Twitter of someone whose letterbox, whose letters from her birth family to her she was an adopter to her child. She got a they disappeared. Nothing had happened for a while, and she'd asked, and nothing. And then they moved the people. The office, the letterbox contact occurred in moved, so they moved down three corridors to the left. As they're emptying the offices, they found a year's 18 months worth of letters from a birth family.
Oh God, that's terrible. I heard similar story yesterday as well from a birth father in the group ATD, and none of the letters, his letters weren't getting through, or his and his wife's letters, and neither were vice versa because of a change of address that nobody had really been informed about. Nobody kept up the proper addresses.
Really basic stuff, isn't it? We're not talking about nuanced high tech stuff. We're talking And if we can't get that right, then we kind of have to question how we're going to manage anything a bit more nuanced and subtle.
And this, I'm going to say something that might come as slightly controversial to people. I think that we need to really question the language than the restrictions that are put on letterbox contact. Because just thinking more about this, and talking to the man yesterday, I mean, he's not allowed, in the letters that are going to be starting up, he's not allowed to say, they're not allowed to say mum and dad or I love you. That was a criticism that came from a number of the birth families. But interestingly, and I think this, it was a criticism that came from a young adopted person as well, that actually her letters have been redacted. Terribly, and I asked her what she would have wanted, what she thought was written, and she said, I think they said mum and dad and love, and I said, well, what would you have thought if you'd received that? She said, I would have liked that, at least that I knew they would have cared. Similarly, another adopted person said, what rights do adopted people have not to know that they were loved by some people? I think she was saying it in relation to her foster carer, but it's in the report. So I think we can just have those quite, critical discussions. What are the consequences of for the different parties involved of the language and of the sort of, the sort of truths or routines that have come about letterbox contact, that this is the right thing to do or not right thing to do, where have they come from, and what are the different people's perspectives on it? Those questions need to be answered.
Yeah, and why are we putting blanket rules across a whole... That's shocking, isn't it? Because you think, who are you protecting by, not telling your children that they were loved or are loved? Who are you... What is your fear? And what... but to have a letter that's been redacted, it's like the Stasi state, isn't it? It feels like a really oppressive regime.
Yeah. And certainly the birth families felt that as well. But I think also adopters, struggle with knowing what to put and how to put things. That came out certainly in one of the seminars, really quite strongly, and really adopters wanting to do the right thing. But it's so... We also maybe need to have much more of a debate about what those letters should look like, as well as what support can be given to continue them.
Rather, like you said, rather than just these rubber stamp rules, you will do this, you will not do that. And if you do this, we will stop the contact.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, you've got me blood up now. I'm all spitting feathers again. I would really recommend people read it, because I think there's some really interesting stuff that might just give you a slightly different perspectives on issues that actually a lot of people feel really strongly about. And we agreed. And I think that was one, as I came away from the seminar, and it was a really interesting day, that I came away thinking, actually, even though we're on the opposite side of the tables, that's not a terrible phrase. We agreed on an awful lot of things about the welfare of our children. Of our shared children, and we
agree. Absolutely.
And that was what kind of was quite moving about the days. You know, we disagreed about language. We disagreed. You know, there was all kind of bits that we weren't on the same page with. But there was that we all said we all want the best for our children. We all want to see them thrive and grow up knowing that they're loved and protected.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And, you know, and just possible, you know, just increasing possibilities for breaking down barriers and breaking down, you know, polarization and defensiveness is really important so that people can talk and try and understand others' perspectives on things.
Yeah. Oh, so much food for thought there. Well, Anna, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And I will continue to let people know about the report. I'll put a link on the podcast and everything. And hopefully it will just, it's all part of a kind of a movement to kind of just improve stuff, make it better. Make it better for the sake of children.
Got to keep trying to make it better.
Got to keep trying. Okay, well, thank you very much. And I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, there you are. That was the interview with Anna. So, and Scott, I mean, I'm not disclosing anything I shouldn't when you saying that when we talked about getting Anna on, you said, all right, okay, what's that all about then? What was all that about? I have put you on the spot.
No, you haven't put me on the spot. I guess that for me, it was just, you know, the headlines of the report and people talking about it and, you know, people I know talking about it as well. So I wasn't just, you know, reading through Twitter of people that I didn't know. I actually know a lot of these people and they weren't exactly complimentary of the report. And especially it's kind of focus on adoption. So I was a little bit, I wasn't keen to do the interview. That's not why I didn't do the interview.
Because you weren't available. Yeah.
I was not available. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's kind of.
So what do having not
I'm
having
not sure it's changed my mind, but right. I can see some of the comments, some of the points that she's making, and I guess the one thing that sticks out for me is the fact that she said, you know, that this was not about adoption. Yes. As in, you know, as in children that are placed for adoption. It's about the process and the system.
Yeah.
It's not about us as adopted parents. I still don't think it was overly useful for adopters, some of the stuff, but yeah,
But that's headlines. You are referring to headlines, aren't you? And I think there was headlines that kind of took out which is the nature of headlines, though, isn't it? That
of course it is. Yeah, you pick out the worst or the best, don't you?
And they'll hook people in and sell your story.
Extremes, exactly. But yeah, I'm still not convinced.
Right.
Personally, I still think there's a lot of positives. You know, contact. You know, massive thing. And I really, really agree with that. I, you know, and that's what I mean. I'm kind of there's more. In my view now, as you know, being an adopter for 12 years and thinking about things like contact and how that's affected us and how things have changed over the years, the Northern Ireland bit, that was really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm using one of your words now. Sober and interesting. but that was such an eye-opening comment that was made about Northern Ireland with their contact.
Yeah, I hadn't realised that it was kind of
not at all.
That judges would make orders in relation to how much, and it sounded like an awful lot from what Anna was saying.
Six times a year, she mentioned.
Yeah, which does seem slightly, well, without knowing the circumstances, I think it sounds onerous. But I think, I think some of the stuff what kind of really made me think was the conversation, and I sort of did say at the end, you know, the event we went to, which we were talking about earlier, some of the points that group of people were talking about were the exact recommendations that the inquiry was saying that we need
to. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, we need to look at contact. We need to look at again. We need an individualized model. And of course, you always got to reframe that the inquiry was not about adoption. It was about policy and process, ethics. Yeah. It was about social work. Yeah. And so when social workers are going, I don't have time to make these decisions, I'm being forced to rattle through because often an adoption social worker is not the one making
those decisions.
Nope.
They're not at that process. It'll be a child protection social worker or a, you know, part of that that system will be the ones that say, actually, I think that we should, that the chances for rehabilitation or reintroduction to the family, or there is no available special guardianship, so that links back into there. So actually, we're going to go for adoption. And it's only at that point, after a permanency order has been made, that then you would go to an adoption team.
Exactly.
Yeah. So even then, you know, it raises the questions of, the, you know, we don't hear the voice of the adoptive social workers. I mean, how many adoption social workers are at the DfE?
Well, exactly. That's the thing. And
how many?
Some of the adoption. Well, I don't know. None that I'm aware of.
It's me.
Actually. Yeah.
And I'm not an adoption social. Well, I skirt round adoption, but I don't.
Yeah.
In many ways.
And, you know, you use the word social worker, like, you know, you know what you're doing.
In the broadest sense of the term.
But it's interesting because, you know, and it's right, it's bang on. And what I think it was interesting, it was opening up that conversation between a number of different, and you know, you've done it with the Baswell inquiry. We've done it recently with the other thing that we went to with special guardians, and but you know, the Baswell one was more, probably would have been even more interesting to hear those experiences straight from the horse's mouth. You know, whether it was birth parents or whether it was special guardians or foster carers or whoever, or even adoption social workers, or even, you know, whoever. That would have been,
I mean, the day, I mean, I didn't get particularly into it with Anna, but the day I went was really interesting. And so I was sat on we were split into small groups with kind of a fair mix of people. And I have to say that Bridget and Anna chaired it fantastically. So I'm sat in a group with other, with an adopter, and I'm a social worker, and there was a couple of parents, birth parents. Really tricky. I mean, really, really tricky conversations. But really good conversations. And we disagreed quite strongly.
Yeah.
So I was quite conflicted because I thought, well, I want to, you know, I don't have two personalities, but I do have my social. I'm conscious. I'm in that context. I am a social worker, like in a public context. But I'm also a dad of a child who's experienced terrible things at the hands of adults of birth family.
Yeah.
And so you kind of want to go full on and say, whoa, hold on, you know, you paint this picture of this, and they, exactly the same, wanted to go at me full on and kind of have a proper ding-dong. But we all kind of kept our cool, and Anna and Bridget really chaired it very appropriately and actually drew us to what we could agree on. We all want the best for our children.
Yeah.
We all want them to be safe. We all want them to be protected. And, you know, we... As you know, I had to acknowledge where sometimes the system fails them, but also where it sometimes fails me. Because actually, but ultimately, it has to come back to children. But adoption isn't always about children, is it? That old chestnut.
Well, no, I mean, you know, that's right. But I guess I hear consistently and constantly about, you know, these voices that we never hear from, and that irritates me because I think those voices are key to the future of how children, you know, however you define success within adoption or permanence. But I keep hearing about the fact that, you know, they're not represented, they're not, you know, they don't have a voice. I think things like this are the opportunity for them to have a voice. And I just hope that that opportunity was taken. That's gone a little bit off.
Well, I think,
but,
it'd be worth rereading. I think maybe reread it, and because you know, they were talking to legal professionals, you know, the barristers who are, you know, or whatever role they had in it, but people who are actually doing the mechanics of this legal stuff and looking at the ethics. They were talking to, you know, judges and people from CAFCAS, the children's guardians, who are meant to be in part, you know, CAFCAS sets the guardians who are, represent no one but the child. And you think, actually, all of these voices need to be heard. And we get, for a whole host of reasons, adopters, we get our voices get heard more than everyone's. And I know that I'm perhaps talking to the wrong person because you run the adopt a voice thing. But even then, you know how...
Adopt a voice thing.
I should know. Am I part of it? I have no idea.
You are.
But yeah, I am. But even then, we see the challenges we face.
Mm.
But we're, in some terms, we're the good guys, aren't we? Mm, I'm not saying that, but you know what I mean. We're the
Yeah. I know what you mean. Yeah.
And I work in. I did my second. I don't know that I've told you this. I did my second year, first year student placement when I was a social work student with an organisation called Families in Care, which they support families whose children are in the care system. And includes adoption, but sometimes just children who are in the looked after system.
Mm.
And my mind was just absolutely opened beyond anything I'd ever experienced before that.
Imagine.
To see that the lived reality of those families and a system that was really difficult to negotiate. And then you turn the clock forwards and you'll know, you'll talk to adopters every single day and they'll say to you, this system's crap. I'm really struggling to get in touch with my social worker. And I'm really struggling, you know, and that's just a post-adoption support social worker. So it's, you know, it's important, but it's not that person's got my child and I need to get in touch with them. So, and then we go back to the thing we've talked about at the beginning is that we're middle class and we've got agency and we know how to, it's true. You know how to represent yourself, don't you? You know how to get the best out of an organization. You know, I've talked to Tris and we've joked about, you know, he knows how to complain. He knows how to do it well.
He does.
He's been head of complaints for British Rail or whatever he was.
Literally.
So he knows how to make a good complaint now to get professionals to listen to him. And those are skill set that the families don't have. And you kind of, I have no idea how I ended up at this point of the conversation, but I'm clearly quite passionate.
Yeah, you are, obviously.
Oh, my blood.
I think what's interesting about that, of course, is the fact that these, especially birth families, they could be just as passionate and just as advocacy-led, but there's an underlying issue for them, isn't there? And, you know, whether that's neglect or abuse or, you know, whatever it is, I don't know. But, you know, they could just be like us and in their day-to-day lives, you know?
And you know enough adopters that have become. They've become the parent. They've become the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a fine line between being someone looking for help and someone becoming the problem.
Exactly.
And it's quite scary.
It's very scary. It is very scary because actually, you know, there's that kind of instinct that tells you, well, adopters, foster carers are trained and there's, you know, blah, 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 blah. And actually they should, they're put on this pedestal as being the perfect parent, when in actual fact it can still go wrong for them as well, you know, in the same way it can go wrong for a birth family. So, I think I will take your advice. I shall reread.
And the next podcast, there'll be a quiz.
Oh, no, please don't do that.
What does recommendation 3 say, Scott?
Flick, flick, flick.
Flick, 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 yeah. The sound of pages being flicked.
Yes, exactly. But no, it was really interesting. And actually, I know you interviewed Bridge. It must have been 18 months ago.
It was, yeah. I think it was
October. Goodness, are we that old?
Yes. November 2016.
Okay, so you interviewed her kind of halfway through the initial bits, didn't you? And she was very kind of personable, and actually Anna seemed very personable as well. And I think that, you know, they've done this report for all the right reasons.
Yeah.
I think that I just, I don't know. You're right, headlines are probably not the best thing to make your assumptions on. However, I still think there's a couple of things that maybe personally I just didn't agree with. But, right, you know, we're all allowed our own personal opinions.
Well, you can report back on the next podcast.
Probably not.
Okay.
Because, you know, I don't like being controversial, as you know.
No, you are. Meek and mild.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, I'm slightly confused. Hey, can I advertise something I'm doing?
Oh, depends.
Okay.
Is this product placement?
Product placement. My new
should be an income from this sort of stuff.
It's my new line of handbags.
Go on.
No, on the 19th of April,
Sorry.
19th of April, I'm doing a talk in Leicester.
I know you are, because I'm going as well, because I'm going on for work.
Are you? Oh, right. Well, do you know where it is? It's at 7:30 in Leicester. I don't even know where it is. Yeah. It's a church. Yeah. It's on my Facebook page. But it's on CPV, which is a bit, you know, which I've done a lot. But also, I'm working up some really interesting material around adopter resilience, because I think it's a key thing that we need to train. And I think that there's some really good, I've had some really interesting thoughts, especially linking it to CPV, but generally. So I thought I'd make a thing for that.
Little plug there. Well, I'm going to make another two little plugs, because you are, and this is plugs for you, actually.
Oh, is it?
And then one for both of us. So the first one is Adoption Today is due out in the next few days. It should be landing on people's doormats. And there's a lovely spread on the England page by a certain Mr. Al Coates and a certain Dr. Wendy Thorley.
Oh, what have we done?
Well, you wrote it, so you should know. Oh. So that's there. And then the 5th of July, we're doing our... We're on the road show, aren't we? We're doing the Alan Scott road show.
Yeah, but you've not yet told me what we're talking about. It's not gender politics, is it?
No, it's nothing like that. And it's not about you being my straight husband either.
Oh,
it's,
heavens.
We're talking CPV. CPV.
Oh, who to? I am genuinely interested. Who to? You haven't told me.
I did. I have told you.
You did not. You said, are you free on the 5th? I said yes.
I did say it was about CPV.
No, you did not.
Honestly, in one ear. Go on. Look back your text, look back 3 months of text and tell me. Anyway.
I just deleted my text and you know why I deleted my text.
Yes, I know. Yeah. So there's no trace. Burp. we're talking to the good parents, the good adoptive parents and maybe a few professionals of Essex about child and parent violence. You're going to do a few bits on your current survey. And maybe some of the stuff from the previous one. And
the new survey is just off the scale.
Well, I can't wait to see it. I'm still waiting to see the sneaky peek before it goes.
Really mind-boggling stuff. So, but I need to get my finger out over the Easter weekend and write a chapter. Anyway.
Best you got. So that's what we're doing now. And we're going to obviously have our usual joint banter as well as a little bit of
sensible
strategy. Strategy and stuff, yeah.
So. The cut and thrust of intellectual debate.
Yeah.
Well,
I can tell you.
Yeah.
No, I can't. Actually.
And I want to say thank you for all the people who put an iTunes review, because we've now got 15 reviews.
No.
Shut the front door.
No.
Back the truck up.
We haven't really, have we?
There was my mam. There was my auntie. This one. No.
Trace Paula,
yeah. Kids. No, so that was really good. And if you want to go there and do some more, that's really good. And say whatever you want. Just make it funny. Just.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We like.
Yeah, not like it's really helpful. And you know, even if it is, don't say that. Just say something.
Yeah,
no.
Keep it light. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Have we filled up the banter pool to the brim?
I'm not sure we've done too much banter on this one because it's quite a serious topic, really. But I think we've done the deed.
Okay, well, in that case, I'm going to say goodbye to you. Have a lovely holiday if I don't see you before then.
A biento, au revoir.
Bon Jovi.
Next time I see you, I'll be talking in an Irish accent, so it's all good.
Oh, well, that's something to look forward to.
Fabulous.
Okay, then. Right.
Cheerio.
Ta-ta for now. Bye-bye.
Ta-ta. Bye-bye.